kind of a condensed period here. We were in session till 20 minutes ago or so. So we'll see what we can do, what how far we can get. But the first bill we're going to discuss this afternoon is Senate File 1513, Senator Torres Ray. Deals with highway construction mitigation grant program establishment. So welcome, Senator, and you may proceed. Apparently, Senator, is there an author's amendment you'd like put on the bill to get it in the shape you'd like it? Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Yes, this is correct. We have been working on this language for quite some time, but unfortunately, we missed something very important, and thank you to Senator Gimsey. We were able to really fix this and make it even better. He made me realize that we left off some very significant language out of this bill that really incorporates road construction and transit. I don't know how we did it, but we did that. So I'm very thankful.
Senator,
to you. And I would like to move
that. Bach will move your amendment for you to get the bill, and that's the A1 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. As many of you know, I have been trying to put some language together to support small businesses that have faced some significant challenges due to road construction for quite some time. I faced this in my district for a number of years, and unfortunately, when I got after I got elected, I had really very little time to support the businesses in my own district, because that particular project has been finished. However, they continue to face significant challenges, and this bill is intended to support small businesses that are facing now these challenges, particularly in this time during these economic times when they face multiple challenges in their businesses, but also because we have, as you know, members, we have many projects coming to the state of Minnesota, so we know that this is an area that is of significant concern. Mr. Chairman, I have three members with me, but I am going to go. I have three experts with me who would like to share some stories and share with you some of the challenges that they are facing within their own businesses, but also with the programs that they now coordinate. But before I do that, what I would like to do is present Senate File 1513, just walk through it very quickly.
Sure.
Section 1 of this bill, Mr. Chair and members, provides that the purpose of the construction mitigation grant program is to mitigate impacts of road construction on local small businesses. It promotes retention of jobs in road construction areas, and it provides outreach to public and small businesses to minimize interruption to local commerce. It directs the Department of Transportation, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and local units of government to work together to ensure that the recommendations of the Department of Transportation 2009 report on transportation construction impacts and any related statutory changes are applied when implementing the grant program. And members and Mr. Chair, I want to pass around, you probably receive a copy of this particular report. I started this work 2 years ago, and again, in response to many of my constituents. And what happened at the time was that the Department of Transportation was going through significant challenges, as you recall, with the collapse of the 35W bridge and other projects that were taking place in the state of Minnesota. And so we really didn't have enough time to have hearings and really review this issue in length. So what we decided to do a year ago was to put some legislation in place that will help us put that information together and give this issue really a better and more in-depth kind of study. And this particular report came out of that during this year of review. And I would like to pass it around. I believe that you receive a copy of this, but I'm not sure. And we will be reviewing this with the Committee on Transportation next week, later this week. So that will be related to the actual responsibility of the Department of Transportation and what they have to do to support the communities that are impacted by road construction.
Like a ranger, you'll never be in.
Then subdivisions two, three, and four direct the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development to develop and implement the construction mitigation grant program. It defines applicant, commissioner, eligible road project, local government unit, project, and small business. Subdivision 4 requires that grant applicants submit to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development a proposal detailing a construction mitigation plan. And then the other subdivisions talk about the business experience, parking, visibility, and other issues that require the attention of the road authority and how they need to consult with small businesses. And for this particular committee, what we're going to do, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is really relate to you some stories and struggles that actual business have been going through right now, again, in my district for the Lake Street Construction Project. I have a business owner that will talk to you about his experience. And I have also Eric Nathanson, who is with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, who have worked with a number of businesses in along Lake Street. I also have Manuel Gonzalez, who is the owner of a very successful small restaurant called Manny's Tortas. And I have Linda Windsor, who is working right now with the University Avenue Business Association.
Yeah, we this is good. We like to hear from the folks that were firsthand experience and what happened to them and their businesses. So thank you for bringing these folks in. And however you want to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I will have Eric Nathanson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eric Nathanson. I'm the Financial Resources Coordinator for the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, MCCD. We're a nonprofit business development organization that provides technical assistance to businesses and access to capital for businesses throughout the metro area. We're very pleased to be here to indicate our support for Senate File 1513, and we're glad to see that the legislation will be broadened to apply to transit as well as road construction projects. Over the last few years, MCCD has worked with a number of businesses that have been impacted by transportation projects, and we feel that our experiences can provide some useful input for the legislature. And I'm going to just run through this very quickly because I know that you have a lot of work to do this afternoon. We've specifically, over the last 4 to 5 years, worked with businesses on Lake Street and Lowry Avenue in Minneapolis. Both of those streets were county as opposed to state projects, but they did substantially impact the businesses in those areas. And a couple of the lessons learned from them, we found that the businesses that are most vulnerable during construction projects are the small businesses that are tenants in commercial business buildings rather than the building owners. And the agencies that are engaged in these projects do a good job of informing building owners about schedules and upcoming projects, but sometimes that information doesn't get on to the tenants, and the tenants are the ones that, of course, that are operating the businesses. And I think we're pleased that in this bill there is a provision for a business liaison that will make sure that tenant as well as building owner businesses get information about these projects and get them in a timely manner. Signage is a big issue for businesses that are impacted by these projects, and sometimes the signage doesn't always quite work for the businesses that we've worked with. We had an experience on Lowry Avenue where the businesses, particularly some of the immigrant businesses, told us that their customers were all coming from the north of Lowry, but the signs were on the south of Lowry, and we had to do some work to make sure that the signage got switched so that it really had some impact on the businesses and could really assist them during the construction project. We've done several things. We did some marketing, simple things like little maps. Here's how you get to my business while the road's closed. You may not be able to get onto Lake Street, but you can get onto 21st Avenue, and here's how you find us. We were able to put some shared parking together so that businesses that had issues in front of their street could come together and share some parking on an off-street basis. We also provided some small loans to businesses to help them with their cash flow during the construction period. But what we finally realized is that loans really were not the answer to the problems that these businesses faced, that this was an additional financial burden on them. And while it was useful in some cases, it wasn't for others. Probably the most important thing we learned is that there is a delayed impact to all of this. And on Lake Street, while some of the businesses were able to survive the immediate road construction that happened in 2004, 2005, what the road construction did was basically weaken these businesses so that their long-term viability was impaired. And when their property tax bills came due, in part because of increased valuations because of the road construction plus assessments, that put an additional burden on these businesses. It was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And what we found is that 3 years later, in fact, businesses began to disappear. Last year alone, 20 of them on Lake Street disappeared, and many of them indicated that the beginning of their problems came with the road construction during that period when their sales were strong. Previously, they'd been they had been viable businesses. Right now, of course, businesses are facing a perfect storm, deteriorating economics, freeze on access to credit, and then the disruption that the construction projects will be imposing on them. The deteriorating economic conditions and the access to credit are not issues that you directly can change here. However, construction is a public effort, and that does have a direct impact on businesses, and we feel that if the cause of the distress is a direct public action, that it justifies some remediation. We're all quite hopeful that the stimulus bill of some $600 million will create jobs through transportation projects. However, we're concerned that at the same time that the stimulus is creating transportation projects, if in fact the small businesses are going under, we're going to be losing jobs and offsetting that gain. So we feel that Senate File 1513 can go a long way to help remediate the situation. Thank you very much.
Does your research, Mr. Nathanson, do you believe that that recovery money and the stimulus money is could be used for a purpose like this?
Mr. Chair, we're certainly not experts on the stimulus legislation. We have done some research, and it, there is some indication that there is some funding coming to DEED that might be applicable to small businesses, and hopefully we'll be talking to staff about that. So.
Good. Okay. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. And I have Manuel Gonzalez, who owns a small business, actually three locations in Lake Street.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee. My name is Manuel Gonzalez. I'm a certified chef and owner of Menis Tortas, a small restaurant where you eat the best Mexican sandwich in town. I'm also the president of Mercado Central and the representative of the Latino Economic Development Center for the Lake Street Reconstruction Project. I opened my first restaurant with the help of my sister Victoria in 1999. Until last month, I owned three small restaurants, all located in the Lake Street area in Minneapolis. My sister and I are only two out of many small business owners with entrepreneurial energy in the Latino community. We have taken big risks by becoming tenants of vacant buildings that were redeveloped during the last few years in the city of Minneapolis. Menis Tortas One is one of the 42 small businesses located in the corner of Bloomington and Lake Street in the Mercado Central. Menis Tortas Two is located in the corner 27 and Lake Street in the Coliseum building, which was vacant at the time when Menis moved into that building. And Menis Tortas 3 is located in the old Sears building in Lake Street that now is called the Midtown Global Market. Mercado Central, the Coliseum building, and the Midtown Global Market, the three buildings where our business are located, became what they are today, thanks to the extraordinary efforts of the wide range of people. This business project have attracted and expanded new business enterprise through the reuse and redevelopment of existing buildings located in economically depressed areas. Entrepreneurs like us, who took significant risks make commitments to occupy spaces and buildings that were empty. We are investing our time, resources, and a lot of energy to make this project successful. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, today I'm here to talk about the struggles that I'm facing with all my business. I'm struggling to keep my business open due to the economy, but also because I faced tremendous challenge during the time that Lake Street was under construction. 3 weeks ago, I had to close many stores too, the restaurant that was located at the Coliseum building, Lake and 27. When we opened our restaurant at that location, there were no other business along that intersection, just Dennis restaurants and us. We did well for the very beginning at this location. We started making profit after the first year. The restaurant became very popular shortly after we opened. We were fortunate to win many awards, such as the Paul Wellstone Entrepreneur of the Year in 2003, La Prensa of Minnesota Entrepreneur of the Year in the same year, Best of Food and Wine in 2004, many other publications award like City Pages, Minnesota Monthly, and Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine. We appear in TV news shows several times as special guests. Everything was going great until the Lake Street reconstruction project began in 2004. The reconstructions affect all of our business for approximately 4 years. However, Manny's Tortas too has been the most affected by street reconstruction. This location was a near construction project for approximately 3 years. After the construction of the street was complete, the city began to rebuild the sidewalk located in front of the building. That reconstruction went for 1.5 years. At some point with that year and a half, the city declared the sidewalk reconstruction as the area way abandonment project. That lasts about 6 months. After that street was finished, our building was left with a huge hole in front of Lake Street entrance door. Many customers, they don't want to walk across the boards that were put on the sidewalk to enter our business, especially senior citizens and families with young children who felt unsafe. Our sales dramatically dropped during those months. To give you an example, during the year of 2003, we have an income of about $45,000 a month when our business was doing well. At the beginning of 2004, when construction started, went down 30%, and slowly, at the peak of the construction, our sales went down 45%. And during the construction of the sidewalk, our sales went down 55%. Before we knew it, our profits were down so dramatically, we had to lay off people, and quickly, we got behind with rent. We tried everything, work like hours. My sister and I were working 12 to 15 hours a day for 7 days a week. We searched everything to find financial help. First, we look to the organizations that specialize in helping a small business like NDC, MIDA, Minneapolis Consortium. None of them were able to help us because they didn't have the funds. To loan us money. We then went to the banks, which were not able to help us either. Our last hope was using my credit cards. We tried to negotiate with our landlord to let us pay a smaller amount of rent for 3 months. The landlord said no to our offer because at that same time, his building went into foreclosure. We went to court to try to save Manny's Tortas too with a payment plan. We offered to give him $6,000 as the first payment and pay him the rest in 6 months. Unfortunately, he declined our offer, and the court decision was to allow us 5 days to leave the restaurant. That took years to build. We lost $270,000 in investments and a lot of hard work. All of this was lost for $21,000. The reconstruction of Lake Street was necessary, and the street looks very nice today. The impact of this construction has been devastating to our business. I don't know if you can help me now, but the Lake Street project is now finished. But I'm here to speak on behalf of many other businesses that might face in the same situation in the future. They need your help. Road construction projects are a very big problem for a small business. They cost significant money to building owners who pass the cost along to the business. In our case, we have a lot of significant money due to the decline in business, but we also have to pay the cost of beautification associated with the construction. new benches, trees, etc. We also have significant tax increase due to the construction. We are facing all of these problems in the toughest economic times, and many of us will not be able to survive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you. Another witness, sir.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Linda Windsor, and I'm here on behalf of the University Avenue Business Association to speak in favor of Senate File 1513. University Avenue, from the Capitol to U of M campus, is home to roughly 800 to 1,000 small businesses. Many of them, I should say, 800 to 1,000 businesses. Many of them are small businesses, the one-of-a-kind mom-and-pops that contribute to the diversity and vitality for a mixed-use corridor. Some of these businesses have been on the avenue for generations, while others are new arrivals seeking the American dream. These small businesses provide jobs, tax revenues, services, and goods to our local economy. University Avenue businesses started feeling the pinch of the economic downturn in January 2008. The loss of revenue, coupled with rising property taxes and the recession, have caused decreases in customer traffic, a rise in safety issues, and cash flow problems for many businesses. University Avenue is a unique corridor running through two cities and counties. Hence, the avenue was chosen for a major light rail project, promising to bring better transit, economic development, and a beautiful new streetscape. While other mixed-use corridors have received public investment and improvements through the years, University Avenue has been neglected, with the implication that public investments will arrive with the light rail project. Within 18 months, construction on University Avenue will begin. Under normal construction circumstances, businesses can expect to lose 20 to 50% of their revenues when the street is torn up in front of their businesses. This represents a huge and perhaps insurmountable challenge to the small businesses that are already struggling with the recession. In addition to the sagging economy, business owners are feeling anxious about their unanswered questions related to the light rail project. Will I lose all of my on-street parking? When will the road be torn up in front of my business? What business mitigation measures will be addressed in the project, and what other assistance will be available? Businesses don't have time and resources to stay informed, find assistance, and run their businesses. The University Avenue Business Association, UABA, began organizing in August 2008 and is now 132 members strong and growing. UABA published its call for action on March 4th after months of research, surveys, and work by its staff and members, which I think you have in hand. The call focuses on business mitigation and other important issues related to the light rail project. Currently, we are in preparation for the light rail construction, and this includes ongoing organizing and outreach for small businesses along University Avenue. UABA needs staff and resources to support its growth, and important work is a strong collective voice of small businesses. This work includes email, phone calling, flyering, and door-to-door communications, networking with partners and local groups, maintaining a user-friendly website with timely information, and preparation for UABA business meetings. Construction mitigation liaison. UABA needs a business construction mitigation liaison to work on behalf of small businesses with the Met Council, construction contractors, cities, counties, state officials, and the local community to help businesses prepare for and survive light rail construction. Specialized business assistance, monthly informational workshops for businesses. UABA holds monthly events on topics related to businesses and light rail. These events have been important for disseminating information, gathering feedback, and developing stronger relationships between businesses and the broader community of stakeholders. Staff and resources are essential to continuing these monthly events. Business Resource Center, is collaborating with local community partners to open a business resource center to provide marketing, energy efficiency, business planning, technical, financial, and legal assistance for businesses on University Avenue. Startup costs, part-time staff, and donations of equipment, programs, and expertise are needed. Marketing and branding are crucial for survival in this economy, and more so when the road becomes torn up. Small businesses depend on a strong, loyal customer base. With light rail construction looming and the major changes that will come after light rail is operational, small businesses need to position themselves to attract a greater and more varied clientele through individual marketing for existing businesses. They need resources for research and development to expand marketing niche, signage, print, radio, and other advertising, and branding of University Avenue. Resources are needed for marketing University Avenue as a place with its own special mix of businesses, neighborhoods, diversity, and history. They also need a public process to brand University Avenue with a unique logo and tagline under which the businesses, neighborhoods, and light rail train can all be connected and valued for their contributions to a prosperous University Avenue. In closing, I'm here today to ask for your support for small businesses along University Avenue as they struggle in this unforgiving economy and face the major negative impacts of light rail construction. These small businesses employ thousands of people who pay their taxes, support their families, live in our communities, and provide a vast array of services and goods right in your Capitol front yard. Any loss of businesses on University Avenue will be a loss of jobs, revenue, and quality of life. The light rail project is nearly $1 billion, and its success depends on the careful planning and design of the trains, tracks, and stations, as well as the surrounding community of businesses and neighborhoods. Take a moment to think about the downside of what this could be. Trains running down the middle of University Avenue surrounded by struggling businesses, vacant storefronts, blight, and devastated neighborhoods. Now imagine what it will be with your help. Trains full of riders surrounded by a viable and diverse business environment, healthy neighborhoods, and sidewalks of people going about their everyday business of life. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm honored to be here, and I thank you for your time and consideration.
How do you look at this to be the Commissioner of Deed makes the grants to the businesses that qualify? Is that how it works?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deed is the agency that works with small businesses, and while the impetus for this effort comes from the transportation sector, the expertise in working with small businesses resides with Deed. Deed has several programs. Our agency participates in them. So I think that Senator Torres-Rae, in putting this together, felt that while this is a transportation-related effort, that Deed was the place that small businesses receive assistance, and so that's why the legislation was focused on that agency.
And rightfully so, I believe. Senator Torres.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And again, you know, we started this project with the idea that we needed to talk to transportation and that this is an issue that transportation needed to deal with. But as we talked to the business, we realized that we needed to do more than that, that the work that transportation needs to do was critical, but we also needed to support small businesses so that they can prepare themselves. And the Department of Transportation is really not placed to do so. They can work, you know, with signage and the report and, mm-hmm. and the legislation includes some of that work, but clearly we see that that will not be enough. And, Mr. Chairman and members, this is particularly true for areas where we don't have organizations like the organizations that Mr. Nathanson and Ms. Windsor have. We have many towns, small towns, and really cities in suburban and rural Minnesota where we don't have organizations like this. And so it is really much more complicated for these small businesses to come together and really understand what is going to happen. The University Avenue project is really an outstanding effort, you know, run with volunteers and staff that really work overtime, and they are underpaid. This is a very small organization that is doing a lot of work with thousands of people. But that is a very unique case, and we need to support that effort because they need to do a lot more. But in most areas of the state of Minnesota, we don't have organizations that could help small businesses organize a plan.
So this liaison person would be a resource for, I can imagine rural Minnesota would even be better for them. Because Senator Bach?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little confused. All along I have thought the Central Corridor was going to be a good idea, I've been told, and it was going to bring all of this business and all this expansion. And last week we had a bill in the Tax Committee that the City of St. Paul wants to extend their TIF districts by 25 additional years because they need to plan for all of, I don't know. But I'm just, all of a sudden I'm hearing that the Central Corridor is going to be a burden, and all along I've heard everybody thought it was going to be such a good idea. But what I'm wondering about, Mr. Chairman, is don't we have a process, and maybe Council knows this or maybe Mr. Nathanson knows, but don't we have a process where a business that feels they've been impacted by a project like that where they can go to the LCC and file a claim for some help? And maybe somebody that's been around here longer than me knows. But I thought we had a process in place where people could file a claim with the LCC. And I've never served on the LCC, so I'm not.
I don't know what to, you know, Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we're not aware of any businesses, at least that we've worked with in the Twin Cities, that's gotten any kind of legal remedies because of the road construction activity. And if there is a process, it certainly is not well known to businesses. We understand that the transportation agencies rightly maintain that their job is to move the projects forward, and that in the past they've not been able to provide direct assistance to businesses. And I think that's why Senator Torres' bill has come up with the new approach that there would be some mechanism in state government to directly assist businesses, because that's missing right now, at least as far as we can tell.
I think there's a remedy for the landowners, you know, if they're taking land and right away, and then they have what they call a commissioner's hearing, and there's some remuneration there. But then I don't think the business owners are really, unless you own the building, am I right there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
So you're trying to protect, Senator, or not protect, but look out for the, not just the person that owns the real estate, because I think when they come through and take 20, 30 feet, they, you know, pay the owner, but they don't pay the tenants anything. Is that kind of correct?
That's
my understanding.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And this is particularly true for small businesses. Most of small businesses really don't own the building that where they have their businesses located. And, you know, part of why I wanted to bring this to your attention is because, you know, when you talk to the Department of Transportation, they do have staff, and they say that, you know, they do the best they can to really help the community around a construction project. But the reality is that when it comes to small businesses, people feel like, you know, that's kind of really not their business to really meet with all of these businesses and work with them and try to figure out how to put a plan in place. So for areas like, you know, my district or St. Paul, we do have some organizations. Even though they are very small, they are working with them. But most of the state, the business around the state of Minnesota do not have access to these kind of organizations.
All right. I think we probably have to move along. We have an hour already into this.
Quick question.
Tomasoni? Yes.
Once upon a time, I dabbled in insurance, and there was something called business interruption insurance, and I think it was for exactly this purpose. Do any of you have any knowledge of something called business interruption insurance? Because you should if you don't.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, we've you know, worked with lots of businesses. There may have been some efforts to try to obtain this, but the small businesses that we've dealt with don't have the ability to access those kinds of resources, or at least they can't in a way that's affordable to them.
This is an insurance. It's just talking to an insurance man. It's not accessing resources. I would assume that they all have an insurance man, and they all talk to insurance businesses. And then just so I'm clear on the funding, because I think eventually it has to come toward Senator Murphy's committee and toward my committee, if there is federal stimulus money not available, the request would be for a general fund appropriation. Is that that is Senator?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Right. Senator Thomas.
Okay. Right. Now, yes. Mr. Chairman, is the intent also to just make this a one-time thing, or have it continuing in for the future also in the event something like this happens again.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomassoni, we would like it to be ongoing, but we were particularly interested in really figuring out a plan for the next 2 or 3, 4 years because we have so many construction projects that are going to take place in the state of Minnesota, and we want businesses to be prepared.
Well, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, I'm a little troubled. So a city plans a street project, and then businesses are impacted, and somehow the state then should reimburse the businesses? I mean, cause isn't that what we're – I mean, potentially isn't that what could happen here? Is a city decides to do some project and businesses on the city street are impacted, we then want the state to pay that impacted cost? And how do we ever control that, the cost of that?
Senator Torres,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Back, I think the intent here is that the state of Minnesota will have a plan. We are facing really significant challenges with small businesses, and as you can tell, as you can see, really this legislation is intended to deal with state projects. What I learned, Senator Back, is that the cities, even the city of Minneapolis, which is a large city that deal with a really huge number of businesses, do not have the resources to put something in place. And even if they did, what we find is that they really design something that is supposed to be there for that particular project and is not intended to be there to address kind of, they put a model in place that will deal with that situation, and we don't have a state program in place that will really look at, you know, mapping out projects, making this information available to the entire community, making customers be aware of what's going on. And transportation is moving in that direction. You will see that in this project. But the intent here is that the state will assume some responsibility, Senator Back, and we do not intend, you know, to take over the responsibilities of the cities because they will have to assume significant responsibility, and they do so right now. But the intent here is really to have a more state-assisted program for small businesses so that it could work not only, you know, in the cities, but in all areas.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
if
we're talking about state projects like the Central Corridor, I mean, this government, state's going to pay, state or federal are going to pay for that. I understand us taking on some obligation there if businesses are impacted, but I really struggle with, I mean, you have a definition of local government that includes city, town, special district, or other political subdivision. I mean, if a school district along their street decided to do something and businesses were impacted, I mean, this is just pretty broad. I mean, if it applied to state projects, I mean, I understand that, but it just seems a lot broader than that.
Okay.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, I don't even know how you, Senator Tomassoni, is going to score it and what it would cost. I don't even know how you would do that. But.
May I just comment on one from the business perspective along University Avenue? That is a multi-jurisdiction project. It's not just a state project. And our presence here relates to the fact that, as you can see in our call to action, we're looking at all pieces of possible help for small businesses. We're not just coming here for the help, and we don't expect that you could possibly help, you know, put forward a plan that would even cover the kinds of help that will be needed. But this would be a piece of it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand University Avenue. I get that. And that's a project we're all very well aware of. But the little town I'm from, Cook, got some USDA money, and they redid River Street. That's our main street. And they put in new sidewalks and new lighting, and the businesses were big-time impacted. How are we ever going to get our arms around reimbursing small businesses everywhere where a city decides to do a street project?
Well,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Back, I want to make sure that this is clear. I don't know when you say reimbursing business, I don't know what that means. But what this is really an effort to prepare small businesses for construction times. So all this is really setting very small resources probably aside to make sure that there is a staff person, that there is a plan in place. In fact, the Department of Transportation admitted already that this is something that they need to do more of, and they are preparing to do that. And so really all this is having perhaps a staff person or two dedicated to put a plan in place so that the communities will be aware of projects that are coming to their area. They will be informing businesses about these projects, the duration of projects, and hopefully connecting to resources within the community, because these communities locally probably will put a lot of money into this process anyway. And the idea will be that they will be collaborating and being prepared, in being prepared for these tough construction.
Well, it's more than money. It's the advice and the planning and the meetings and the signage and on, because, you know, to let the – we had a thing just briefly in the Mendota Bridge out my way, by the village of Mendota in Mendota Heights, and that thing was down for a couple of 3 years, and there were three pretty good restaurants out there, Senator Carlson, that just went under. And I don't know how it could have – what could have been done, but something like this would – at least the awareness would be there, and maybe there's a way to shorten it up. I don't know that, but I think that's what you're getting at. And some pretty good prominent, and that's because of the closing of the bridge for so long, so I don't know what this might have fit in there. Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Bach's point, I served on the Minnetonka Planning Commission for 4 years, and we did have a very formal process by which businesses were able to petition the city if the transportation project was going to negatively impact, and we actually did have to you know, provide some kind of financial assistance in that case. And so I think what Senator Bach is cautioning us is we as a state don't want to take on a burden that really belongs at the local and city and county level. So perhaps I know that you might have another stop after here. Perhaps before it goes to the next stop, you might consider doing some work on it to make very clear that if the state is going to be involved in granting any funds or for that matter, resources, that it ought to be with regard to projects that are state projects. I don't think that we do want to take on the local and city-county burdens.
Okay, we do have...
Mr. Chairman and Senator Boniff, I would be very open to a suggestion if we could clarify that in here. I'll be thankful if you can suggest some language. Thank you.
Well, I just want to... I think you deserve a little... accolades for bringing this kind of an issue forward. I mean, we have to start and consider those small businesses out there. So at the end of the day, I don't know what's going to happen, but we do know Transportation Committee has to hear it and the Finance Committee, so it does have a couple more stops.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to Transportation and then Finance after this.
Okay, somebody, we have a motion to Transportation Committee, re-refer. Senator Tomasoni moves that Senate File 1513 be passed and referred to the Transportation Committee. As amended, do we have an amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Senator Dibble. Senator File 122.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
I'm well, thanks.
Longer than expected, but.
Good issue, though, to chew on a little bit there. So it's interesting. I Mr. Chair, I have part of Lake Street, so I'm sensitive to this issue. Mr. Chair, Senate File 122 has to do with cocoa bean mulch. Cocoa bean mulch is a mulch that has recently become fairly popular for gardeners to use. It's a very fine textured mulch. Used to be very, very expensive and only very exclusive use of cocoa bean mulch around pristine exotic rose species and like. But lately it's become very popular for whatever reason. It's become much less expensive, much more available at places like Home Depot and the like. And it's really nice. It smells really good. It smells like chocolate, and it looks beautiful. And so it's become very, very popular, and lots of folks are using cocoa bean mulch now around their shrubs and their flowers and the like. But unfortunately, cocoa bean mulch, when it's not treated to remove a certain element out of it, known as theobromine, which is also found in chocolate, is very harmful to dogs and cats. And of course, because it smells really good, it smells like chocolate, smells like food, some dogs are inclined to actually eat it. And it's very poisonous to them. Everyone knows at Christmas time or whenever, Easter or whenever, you're not supposed to give your dogs chocolate. You're supposed to keep chocolate away from your dogs because it makes them very, very sick, and if they eat too much of it, they'll die. And as it happens, about a year ago?
2 years.
2 years ago now, two of my constituents called, and they had, ironically, a chocolate lab that...
sorry.
Not to make light, it's ironic. His name was Moose. Ate some of their, or your neighbors or your own?
Our own.
Their own cocoa bean mulch that was around. They had no idea. No one really knows about this. And Moose, unfortunately, did pass away. And so they contacted my office. They had tried to remedy the situation privately and were met with no sympathy and no ability to remedy it. And so they're motivated to somehow or another let folks know that this is something that they need to think about. Now, a lot of companies have become aware of this problem, and cocoa bean mulch can be treated fairly easily through a washing and baking technique, and the theobromine can be taken out fairly easy, and a lot of them are now doing that. So the bill that we propose, Mr. Chair, simply asks that at the point of sale where cocoa bean mulch is being sold, that some notice be posted on the shelf where the bags are that just lets folks know that that is bad for your dog, and so you need to know about that before you buy it. If the cocoa bean mulch has not been treated to have the theobromine removed. Mr. Chair, I have Dawn Hall, who is the owner of Moose with her husband Terry, and she can tell you a little bit about their story. Also in your packet is a letter from their veterinarian who helped interpret the necropsy that was done at the University of Minnesota that concluded that it was cocoa bean shell mulch that was the culprit.
So, welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you.
We can just hold them.
Good afternoon, and on behalf of myself, my family, and all dog lovers, I do thank you for hearing our story today. My name is Dawn Hall, and this is my daughter, Mayor. She is our firstborn, but the pictures that you'll see and Moose was actually our first child. Moose was a chocolate lab. He was 105 pounds. He was quite a large dog. He was 3 years old. Yeah, perfectly healthy. Actually, 3 days before this event occurred, we had taken him to our local vet, and he was examined for his yearly examination, and he was perfectly healthy, perfectly trained dog. My husband was in the Air Force where he trained and worked with bomb dogs. So as far as Moose, he wasn't one that would get into things. He wouldn't eat. He never ate people food. So this, you know, certainly with us having the cocoa bean mulch in our yard, and like Senator Dibble said, if you've ever had it before or smelt it, it does smell like chocolate, so it does draw the animals towards it, in which she and Moose at that time did consume the cocoa bean mulch. Basically, just kind of a long story short, we moved here 2 years ago from Atlanta, Georgia, my husband, myself, and our dog Moose, so just the three of us. All of our family lives out of state. We bought a house in southwest Minneapolis, close to Lake Harriet, where we could enjoy our life with our dog Moose and take him for walks. 4th of July, 2 years ago, we had family coming in town, so we decided to fix up our yard, in which we just moved into our home. My husband went to a local landscaping business and talked about different things that we could spruce up our yard with. So we bought flowers, we bought mulch,
The manager or one of the salespeople at the retailer suggested the cocoa bean mulch. And from it was nothing really popular down in Georgia. We usually just use just bark and whatnot. But he recommended using this, which a lot of gardeners, it just amplifies, you know, grows flowers really well. So we end up buying somewhat like 10 or 12 bags of the cocoa bean shell mulch, and we put that down in our yard on a Friday. That weekend, our family came into town, and we were going to go out on our boat on the St. Croix River on Saturday. Friday, I was inside, wasn't watching Moose. He's usually right there next to our side. My stepfather actually was out there with him. And Moose, unbeknownst to us, I guess, was playing around in one of the mulch beds, and he did consume some, which at the time we did not realize this. The next day we got on our boat, we all went on the St. Croix, and we anchored and kind of went up to one of the little islands, and I was actually playing Frisbee with Moose, chocolate lab, huge, you know, loves to play in the water. And then after a while, about an hour playing out there, I threw the Frisbee and Moose went to go retrieve it. And then I turned and looked and there was no movement, didn't know where Moose was. And I actually walked over and he was laying underneath, actually right there at the surface of the water, instantly died. I touched him, he just floated away. And my husband actually came to him, and again, he worked in the Air Force, was around dogs a lot. He put him on the back of our boat and performed probably about 45 minutes. You would have thought that it was me on the boat dying. Just the attention he gave to Moose, and gave him actually canine CPR, breathing through the nose, breathing through the mouth. We had no idea what had caused this, and we didn't really know he was dead at this point. We actually called 911, which I didn't really realize, but my husband called 911 and they directed us to someone that actually gave us instructions on performing CPR to a dog. So again, as we're heading to the shore and we're out in the water, of course, after again 45 minutes, my husband came to me and told me that Moose, you know, there was something else that we can do and that he did die. When we finally got to shore, I looked at my husband. This is the first dog that I had ever owned. I looked at my husband and said, you know, what do we do now? And he said, well, we bury him. And then again, the dog was completely healthy, had his checkup, you know, a couple of days before. And I wanted to know, you know, a dog just doesn't drop dead like that. I was like, I want to know what happened to my perfectly healthy 3-year-old lab. And at that point, I didn't want to just, you know, push it to the side. We actually called at that time, even driving from the St. Croix, we called the University of Minnesota. We went to the veterinary school there. We dropped Moose off to get a necropsy, which is an autopsy for dogs, and because I wanted to know, again, what had happened to the dog. So a couple days later, again, went by. We were wondering if he had an aneurysm. We were wondering if he had a heart attack. We were wondering about all these different things going through our mind. And then we got a phone call from the U stating that Moose had died from the amounts of theobromine in his system. And again, when we didn't even consider this, we went and looked at the bags of the mulch, and it said on there real big, it said organic mulch, you know, great. Now these great things that you see. And again, the salesperson at the retailer told us that this was a wonderful product. Again, stating nothing to do with animals, the effect that it would have. That day I called the company, and they actually kind of just blew me off more or less. And then I called our vet, and talked to her about it. And, Moose basically just, and he was a large dog and he didn't consume that much. So just think of what it could do to a, you know, 25 or 30 pound dog. So we were very distraught, very distressed about the whole thing. And basically our, awareness, we do want to make everybody aware of this because walking around, you go, again, we live in Southwest Minneapolis where so many families, so many dogs are walked. And after this happened, I would walk around and just see the cocoa bean mulch. You can see it in the yards. You can, and I would just be amazed. Restaurants have it in their gardens. People have this in their homes. And so many dogs could actually, even if we didn't even have it in our yard, our neighbor could have had this product in their yard, and my dog could have possibly went over to it and whatnot. So, and the people that we came across, nobody knows that this could happen. And we would go to Home Depot, go to Lowe's, go to all the little local places, and then there was no signage, No, none of the salespeople knew that this happened or that this could happen, more or less. And we actually called the company that we bought our mulch from, and the manager there had no idea that this could harm dogs or more or less kill them. And I was just astonished about this. We did actually call. We called the local news. We were on Channel 4 News as well as we were on Channel 5 News, and they both reported a story that ran for quite a while, about a week or two, telling our story. They came to our home, interviewed us. So again, we just want to get awareness out, because this was extremely devastating for myself as well as my family. And it's just more or less just letting everybody know. And we got so many emails. Both of the places that my husband and I worked or work, people would call us, let us, or email us, letting us know they had no idea. People ended up pulling cocoa bean mulch from their yards because they did have dogs and, again, weren't aware of this, that this could happen. So, again, we went to Senator Dibble, and we come to you all to let people you know, just more or less inform those that this could happen, and actually does happen. It probably does happen quite often. I was actually emailed from a lady that had cocoa bean mulch in her yard, and her dog had recently passed away. And she had asked me, you know, could this have happened to my dog, which she didn't think about it. They just basically just thought, you know, maybe the dog was just old enough or something had occurred. They just died of natural causes. But again, she, you know, later thought about that this could have been the reason or the cause of her dog's death as well. But because, you know, we went to the U and got the necropsy done, we were able to find this out. So it happens quite often. And again, these are, you know, parts of our family. So we do certainly want to make sure that the retailers are aware and can spread it to the public.
Did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just also want to make sure you have the first engrossment in front of you, because it is different from the bill as introduced. Did that get passed around?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, great.
That's the 36-point type.
Right, and that, yeah, we just made sure that we were talking about the non-processed cocoa bean mulch.
What's 38? I'd like to
was on the little sign.
That was on the first bouquet find, yeah. That's what it.
I typed this up so folks could have an idea.
Senator Bonner.
Also, you're, in your inbox, the latest issue of the Legal Ledger has the story about moose.
How old was the dog again?
3 years old.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, well, thank you for sharing your story. I have two golden retrievers and care very much about them. And just this weekend, you know, my two-year-old golden was eating the plants and choking and sick, and we were giving her the bread to try and get it through. So I know it is traumatic, and so I appreciate, Senator Dibble, you bring it forward. I get concerned about when we try and legislate, you know, state by state, these kinds of matters, because I don't know how you enforce it. How do you make sure that the retailers do this, and what is our process for that? Wouldn't this be a matter that would be almost better dealt with at the federal level, where Senator Klobuchar, for example, we would go to her and they would introduce federal legislation to ban it, or, you know, something of that nature? We often get bills before this committee saying that we should take this action with regard to retail point of sale. And just as a former retailer and as a former manufacturer, I don't know if it's really feasible to implement these kinds of measures.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, certainly, you know, it would all be great if we could encourage the federal government to act and create some uniformity. But I believe strongly in the system that we have devised and the wisdom of our forefathers and founding mothers in this country, that ideas percolate up from the states, and awareness starts building and at the local level on different sorts of ideas and policy innovations and that sort of thing. And ultimately that gives rise sometimes, if it's a good idea, to changes at the federal level. And I would just point you to the Nescheid bill of a couple of years ago, you know, encouraging folks to stay near their gas nozzle, because there were some problems that came to light, and that was a fairly simple, you know, they just put a little sticker on, and there's a fairly standard way that that our state agency has to communicate with retailers. They send out a, you know, regular series of information. This can just be rolled into that information that they send out regularly to retailers to say, if you've got untreated cocoa bean mulch, you have to put up a little sign now. On the ban question, Senator Scoy smiles because he asked me the same question at the last committee. If it's so bad, why don't we just ban it? To me, a couple of responses. One was that's a pretty far reach to simply ban a product from the market, and I'm not convinced that that step necessarily needs to be taken. You know, cocoa bean mulch can be put in gardens where there aren't dogs and there are barriers and the like. This is a simple effort to create awareness. It might create some changes in the market. It's pretty easy to treat. It's not expensive to wash it out and get that
aroma
down to a non-toxic level.
Good luck. We got another 4 or 5 bills. And Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hall, I had the pleasure of meeting your husband in the Ag Committee. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move Senate File 122 for Senator Dibble. I do want to say that as we learned in the Ag Committee, this product is available treated. That's why we added this clause D on the bottom. And I think once that this requirement goes into law, I think the retailers will learn that the treated cocoa bean mulch is available, and that's what they'll buy. And there will be very few of these signs posted anywhere because people will be selling the safe stuff. But I think if anything, it's just to get the awareness out there, and I think it will be a relatively...
Senator Dibble, we
just wanted to be sure folks know it's not bad for their kids. People are worried about kids. It's like chocolate. They shouldn't eat too much, but they probably shouldn't be eating cocoa bean mulch to have a fairly uncomfortable next day or two. But
okay, Senator Gerlach, then we're going to vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble, I understand what people are saying about the awareness, and there's virtue in awareness on anything like this. However, we're doing this as a state law, and one person's awareness is another person's legal liability. And I'm concerned for our retailers. I'll give you an example here. Cigarettes are bad for us, but we don't require retailers to put signs up saying cigarettes are bad. We require it to be printed on the product itself. We go to the manufacturer and require that. So that liability isn't on the retailer. If we're going to create a liability here for retailers if I was an enterprising trial attorney, which I'm not, I know you're not an attorney yourself, unless you went to law school lately, I don't think you are, but if a case was brought and somebody's dog had died and I was the trial attorney and then this law was on the books, first thing you do is you go to the retailer and you say, all right, where's the notice? And, well, it turns out, you know, either a customer or a 16-year-old worker there knocked it behind some product or it got knocked down. Maybe it was printed in 32-point font instead of 36, or maybe the wording was wrong and they mistyped the phone number. There's countless things that could be wrong by the letter of the law here, and that suddenly then you have a retail establishment that is legally being sued and on the hook because of the way, you know, of this whole deal. And I just think that you're going in the wrong direction here, that public awareness, you had some news stories, those kinds of things. But creating a liability, a legal liability like this on retailers, I just don't know that that's the best use of what we should be doing here at the state legislature. So I guess
Senator Day,
some other members.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dibble, when I was here thinking about this, and I don't have any problem with the bill, but it seemed to me somewhere in the testimony it said that this is common in restaurants, and it seems that it was you that brought the bill so that the people in Minneapolis could take their dogs to the restaurant. And so I'm wondering how you're going to straighten that little mess out.
Oh my! Yeah, got a new problem.
Senator, we don't have enough time to.
Okay.
On the Scoy motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Anderson.
There's nothing under the sun.
The Green Job Zone Tax Incentives, and I know you've been, you and others have been working on this for a long time. We have Senator Rosen has a Green Job Opportunity Building Zones. bill after this, so we've got two that. Welcome to the committee, Senator, and proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the chance to hear Senate File 1232 today. This is a kind of a new improved version of the bill that I introduced last year to create green job zones, and this year I'm bringing forward a proposal that's very, very narrowly targeted and more specific than what I proposed last year. And by way of background, I just want to mention a couple of things that came up in our studies and discussion with the Green Jobs Task Force. We heard a lot about our legislative initiatives that have been successful at generating the market for renewable energy products around the state of Minnesota. But what we found is that we haven't been quite as successful at generating the manufacturing base from those products and from those policies. And in fact, we heard a number of times that even if we put in laws, which I hope we do, that encourage installation of more solar panels around our state, for example, many of those solar panels are imported from China. And so it seems to me that if we really want to have a green jobs economy that gets all as much economic benefit as possible from our good policies in the energy arena, we need to focus more on the manufacturing base and trying to get those products made here whenever we possibly can. And a couple of the approaches that I put bills together on are, number one, to create incentives for the manufacturers that are site-specific, like this bill, as well as some procurement bills that will give incentives for Minnesota state purchases to focus on products made in Minnesota. That's in a different bill, though. So I'll describe this bill, but just to start and say that what's really unique about it, how it's the main area in which I've limited it, is that it's focused only on manufacturing jobs and on manufacturers. And the reason for doing this is, as I mentioned, that's an area that I think we need to target that we haven't been as successful at targeting in our economic development efforts and our green energy efforts. We also know that the manufacturing job losses have been so horrendous, and that job loss has hit us hard in Minnesota as well. The numbers that I can just share with you briefly on this are that between 2001 and 2009, Minnesota had a net loss of over 18% of our manufacturing jobs in the state. That's over 74,000 manufacturing jobs lost. And, of course, a good chunk of those were just in the last few months in the last year, but there's been a steady trend of loss, which has been really unfortunate. And in St. Paul, where I live, we've lost over 80% of our manufacturing jobs in our city over the last decade or so. And so it's really been a steady, steady drain. And we've been hurting in this area. We also know that these are the kind of jobs that we want in our state and in our cities because they tend to be very good-paying, sustainable jobs. And so we want more of them. So the way that we set up this bill is to put together green job zones, which would be designated to be in particular locations. And this is another part of the bill that's very, very targeted. We want to focus on sites that have lost manufacturing jobs in particular. And so we're targeting it to only green manufacturing types of industries and focusing only on sites that were previously developed or had a company that closed down, a manufacturing industry that closed down or is likely to close down. And in that category, we include the Ford plant in the city of St. Paul. So let me, I'm just going to point to the language that I'm talking about so I can explain it to you. If you look on page 19 and 20, that's where the real definitions are that I'm talking about. And I'll explain it after the testimony. But briefly, these incentives would apply statewide. A company that located in a green zone would be exempt from state and income and sales taxes. And I do not include any property tax changes in this bill. I think that should really be left up to the local level. It's targeted, as I said, to green manufacturing, to new industries, new manufacturing facilities in previously developed locations. either a brownfields or a manufacturing site that's sitting empty and vacant. And as I mentioned, the Ford plant. I wanted to mention that this is an issue of statewide importance, and it's really hit me that it's not just an issue that I have experienced in my city, but I've heard from people around the state about this concern and about the need for this type of legislation. I wanted to mention Senator Erickson Rope's information that she gave me. She contacted me this summer and said, what can you do to help? In my district alone, she lost in 1 month, they lost 400 jobs in two different manufacturing plants. And that was a perfect example of the loss of manufacturing jobs that tend to be concentrated in areas in a specific place. So you have facilities sitting empty. You have a workforce. So the need is there. The workforce is there. All we need is an incentive to get the companies to open up and shop right here in an existing location. So that's what the bill is all about. I'm going to let some witnesses give you some more information and some good insights about this idea, and then we can talk a little bit more specifics about the bill.
Just before people get started, if it would be possible to be very concise, and I don't want to limit testimony, but we're trying to get through three more bills in the next half an hour. So we talked a lot about this, and this is a wonderful idea, Senator Anderson, but if we could really target to the language, that would be very helpful, and I would appreciate that. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
And also for being here.
We'll be brief and concise, and I think my witnesses realize that time is very limited. So let me just introduce them. I have John Dyvig from the Blue-Green Alliance, Lynn Hinkle, who was a UAW member and officer at the Ford plant site, and Dan Thies from the Energy Harvest Group, who's working on a manufacturing plan for battery storage. I think you're first.
Hi, I'm John Dibbig. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm with the Blue-Green Alliance here on behalf of our executive director, Dave Foster. I'll skip over the employment figures that I had as part of my talk to shorten this up. We'll just suffice it to say we're losing manufacturing jobs, and we're losing them quickly, and it's one of the sectors here in the state where we're losing them at a much faster pace than at a lot of other – than any other sector. Senate File 1232 is an opportunity to target scarce resources where there's the greatest opportunity for long-term growth in trying to help foster green manufacturing jobs. And they can help build on projects that are already underway. The Blue-Green Alliance has helped the Twin Cities to complete phase one of the Twin Cities Green Manufacturing Initiative, where we've identified 29 different areas for growth of green products. And thanks to the legislature, we're moving forward with a phase two to dig deeper and lay plans to encourage new green manufacturing jobs. The Green Manufacturing Initiative is looking at a wide spectrum of products, such as windows, insulation, HVAC controls, new battery technology, and parts for wind turbines. Some of these are cutting edge, while others are long-time standard products. Creation of green job zones should allow immediate capitalization on the information being compiled, and will provide a jumpstart to help the Twin Cities implement a green manufacturing strategy. A great example of a current green manufacturer that we have is Innovent, which is a relatively new manufacturer in northeast Minneapolis. They make an air exchange system that brings fresh air in and exhausts stale air from inside of a building, but it also exchanges the heat. And so the fresh air coming in gets heated by the stale air that's being sent outside of the building. They located in Minneapolis in part because they saw a dedication by the city to the new green economy. Green manufacturers are looking for signals, and this bill would be a great signal. And I would encourage your support to Senate File 1232.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dibbick. And Mr. Lynn Hinkle or Dan Thies are here.
My name is Lynn Hinkle. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate File 1232. As I said, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm a retired union rep from UAW Local 879 at the Ford plant. Still active in developing green job opportunities for Minnesota in general and green manufacturing options for the Ford site in particular. I applaud the efforts to promote green jobs zone and Senator Ellen Anderson's longstanding leadership to translate Minnesota's nationally recognized environmental standards into equally impressive economic development. Senate File 1232 sends a clear message that Minnesota is open for green business. Other states have had preliminary success translating global warming mandates into good green jobs, but Senate File 1232, as part of a larger green economic development program, signals Minnesota's intent to capture significant value in this new market. This is important. As our state continues to shed family-sustaining manufacturing jobs, as Senator Anderson just spoke of, at an alarming rate, the good news is that the new energy economy and many of the clusters such as solar PV and wind turbines and even electric vehicles are still in play. And with the right set of targeted tools, such as tax-abated green job zones in Minnesota, could emerge as a new economic engine linked to its environmental leadership. Let me say before I discuss some possible enhancements to the bill before you that it provides incentives for either a single-use or mixed-use green conversion of the Ford site. Clearly, the shorter-term stimulative effort or effect of a single-use conversion would be preferable, but a longer-term mixed-use with green manufacturing could still create as many family-sustaining jobs building solar panels or wind turbines or both on that site. The question of what resources are needed to achieve this is important. Our solution should be at the scale and complexity of the need and then timed to consolidate market clusters quickly. This is consistent with the wording and the intent of Senate File 1232 as one important tool in a proposed suite of green economic development initiatives. Recently, I presented information to the solar industry stockholders in Minnesota convened by the Office of Energy Security about the prospects of a solar PV manufacturing cluster in Minnesota. In analyzing dozens of startups and expansions in other states, it's worth noting the public-private mechanisms used by Sunlight in Toledo, Polysilicon in Pennsylvania, and the Solar Resource Center in Ulster, New York. For the sake of brevity, let's just look at one of those examples, Sunlight. Sunlight's manufacturing launch was enabled by a rapid and well-timed public infusion of funds as tax incentives, which were approximately $2 million, and Ohio, as we all know, Toledo's in Ohio, an Ohio loan guarantee of $5 million, followed by an Ohio bond and grant program of another $7 million. Now, the good news is that this isn't where it stopped. This was able to leverage at least twice that amount in private capital, calculated to develop a couple hundred early-stage direct jobs in that facility. But just as important, perhaps even more important, it created a whole suite of indirect jobs in Toledo's developing solar supply cluster. Senate File 1232 deserves your support as an important complement to other mechanisms that together correlate to the scale and complexity of green manufacturing needs in Minnesota that are timed to consolidate green clusters quickly.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Thies?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dan Thies. I am CEO of Energy Harvest Group, St. Paul Company. We are a large-scale photovoltaic and solar thermal design development firm. And we are in the process right now of partnering with a company called iCell Systems in California to develop manufacturing in St. Paul of lithium-ion storage batteries that we are bringing to the state. I am here today to ask for your support for Senate File 1232. The incentives in the file add to the tools that small and growing businesses can use to benefit not only themselves and the community. We are partnering also with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers to make sure that the 500 jobs that we bring here are sustainable jobs that benefit the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Anderson, we have the A2 amendment, which is sort of a technical cleanup amendment. It's been passed out to members. I'd like to know if Senator Rosen will move the A2 amendment. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the amendment prevails.
Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Tomasoni.
Chair, here's what I'm having trouble wrapping my arms around, Senator Anderson. I don't think there's a definition of green jobs in here. And we just had a report from the auditor on the job Z, and we have another bill coming up later about green job Z and how the job Z actually made winners and losers. And then we have, I also had a hearing down in Senator Ortman's district to see how her district was a loser in the job Z because of the way that things were cordoned off by decisions made by commissioners who designated job Zs. And now we're putting in another bill that we're going to have zones made up where you, if you're located in the zone, you can get a job Z credit. But if you're not located in the zone, you don't get a job Z credit. Wouldn't we be better off just having a green job definition and say if you're creating green jobs, you get a credit? That way everybody would qualify and you wouldn't have to worry about winners and losers and people moving from one spot to another. This seems to me like setting up blocks of places where people can do green jobs and then they can't do it in other places. And I don't understand why we're continuing down the same road of something that sort of has been proven to be unsuccessful.
So, Senator Anderson, I think some of what you just referenced is on lines, starting at lines 19, 19. Perhaps you'd like to refer to just sort of the green jobs and then the question about targeting areas.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I really don't disagree with the points you're making. I think I'd love to have a statewide tax credit to help all green jobs, but this is a very small-scale approach, and it's focused. It does have the definition that it uses is lines 19, lines 19 to 22, and it's, as I mentioned, it's only for manufacturing companies, so it would be for manufacturing of products that reduce environmental impact and increase the efficiency of the use of resources such as energy, water, and materials. Or in the case of the Ford plant, it would be eligible if that plant started making vehicles that had a higher fuel economy, that were more efficient than the current one. So in other words, if they retooled it. And we could certainly change this to be other uses at that plant. The reason that this is site-specific, Senator Tomasoni, Madam Chair, is that it's also only, if you look at the next page, it's only, you're only eligible, if you look on page 20, lines 25 on, it's only eligible at a previously developed industrial site or a closed manufacturing facility or, in the case of the Ford plant, one that we're trying to prevent from closing. So it's very narrowly targeted. It's not about just setting up a zone somewhere where a business could move to. It's about taking a site that's closed down where jobs have been lost, for the most part, shut down or sent overseas or whatever, and replacing, finding some new company to come in there and set up shop. So it really is intended to be a lot more targeted. I think that will overcome maybe some of your objections. So if you have, Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, if you have some empty facility sitting vacant in your neck of the woods, which I know you do, where companies have shut down and jobs have been lost, they would be the ones that would be eligible. It's not about moving a company from place to place. It's about trying to fill a need where the jobs have been lost.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that helped a little bit, but I think I'd just rather that your bill was on page 19 and that was it. In other words, if you create green jobs, you get a tax credit, because I think you're going to end up doing what I said you're going to, what the job Z legislation did, and created winners and losers, and we'll be moving things around. But I hope I'm wrong.
Are there other Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, I'd like to commend you for all the work you have been doing on this for years. I think you've done a tremendous service in this area, and it is all about jobs, and especially green jobs. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to move Senate File 1232 be recommended pass and referred to Jobs Energy Committee. Is that correct?
Is this going to the tax committee? It was in the tax committee. I think it's been re-referred here for discussion.
Okay.
And is there further discussion on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Rosen, and thank you to the committee. Appreciate it.
And next is Senator Rosen with Senate File 1062. And do you have an amendment, Senator Rosen, a small amendment?
Madam Chair, you wouldn't mind. I'm going to save those amendments for Energy Committee because that's
okay,
where they
very good.
Are long
very
in the,
good.
In the, in, just because we are in a time crunch. Madam Chair and members, I have Senate File 1062 in front of you, and it's the governor's premier economic development bill that he's introduced this year. And it focuses and utilizes on some of Minnesota's best resources to create green and clean technology. And this will help us reach our 25 by 25 renewable energy standard that we've set in place in 07. But it'll also help us to create, promote, retain job growth. And I think Senator Anderson said it very well. We are losing in that area, but we have so much to offer. And Senator Tomasoni, this is the statewide green jobs tax exemption bill. And I had my testimony all set up really good, Madam Chair. And for the sake of time, I'm going to just basically say that it's very similar to Jobsy, except with some key elements that have been put in place. And as you all know, in this committee, we had the Jobsy hearing where we tightened up last year Jobsy because of the recommendations from the OLA. And so the language in the bill is very tight, I must admit. But similar to the current Jobsy, but the differences are they will be, the tax exemptions will be anywhere in the state. There will not be green jobs, per se, zones. There will be no relocations within the state. And it'll give the business a full 12 years if they sign the agreement by December of 2015. And just to quickly point out a couple of the key parts of the bill that I think are important is that there is prevailing wage in the bill on page 21, line 19. It does specify and define what a green jobs is in recommendation from the Green Jobs Task Force, and that's on page 20. So you can have green products, which are manufacturing products, renewable energy, green services, environmental conservation, and I can go in more into that detail, but I do have a testifier here, Madam Chair and members, that I'd really like to testify.
That would be wonderful, Senator Rosen. And I know there are some other provisions in this bill that are similar to other bills we've heard. So let's,
right.
If we could focus on that. And since you have someone here, why don't you?
Well, Madam Chair, just one more thing.
Yes.
Just to say what is exempt. It's the individual income tax, the corporate franchise tax, the state sales and use tax, and the local sales and use tax, property tax, the wind energy production tax. That's different than Senator Anderson's. And it also provides a job credit against income tax for salaries at or above $35,000. And then, of course, we have the CAPCO, or the Small Business Investment Company Credit, which you're very familiar with, Madam Chair. And we also have the Angel Tax Credit. The differences between your bill and this bill is the CAPCO creates a $63 million capital pool for investing in qualified small emerging green businesses and provides a 60% tax credit for insurance companies. So the total program is only $38 million. And for the Angel credit and the CAPCO, it must be headquartered in Minnesota. It has to have a minimum of 51% employees, less than 100 employees. Oh, excuse me, a minimum of 51% employees in Minnesota, less than 100 employees, and pay at least 75% employees at a wage greater than 175% of the poverty level. And it'll create jobs of approximately 55,000 a year. And the Angel tax credit is a 25% tax credit, similar to yours, for small emerging technology. So it's a $12 million program at $4 million for 3 years after a three-year holding period. And as you know, this is an area that has seen a decline in investing, so we need to really bump this area up. And Article 4 is something to do with the biomethane, biomethane energy, and it promotes small-scale renewable energy, anaerobic digesters, gasification, solar, and it helps the utilities to meet their 1.5% conservation improvement program goal. So that was very quick, Madam Chair. And
and also the investment credits are targeted 50% to green jobs,
yes,
which is different than the bill which I have authored, which is broader.
Right.
Not to, that it would not involve green jobs, but we wouldn't. They would be more open to whatever high technologies.
That is an important part of this entire thing.
Right.
And I have with me Mr. Chuck Hayes, and he's the vice president for Sage Electrochromix from Faribault. So I really appreciate this time.
Very good. So welcome, Mr. Sage Hayes. Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you for the opportunity to testify for just a few minutes. My name is Chuck Hayes. I'm a vice president at Sage Electrochromix in Faribault, Minnesota. Sage manufactures a green, clean, new energy technology called electrochromic glass. It's a conservation technology. This electronically tintable glass on the surface on the exterior of a building provides not just glare control, but more important, it provides solar heat gain control for a commercial building. The U.S. Department of Energy has been a strong backer of SAGE as we've developed, and their studies indicate that electrochromic glass working with the lighting and the heating air conditioning systems in a commercial building can reduce the energy consumption of a commercial building by up to 40%. And since commercial buildings account for over 40% of the energy consumed in the United States from all sources, it's a very significant conservation technology for our energy future. It takes many years to incubate new manufacturing technologies. Sage began its journey in 1989 in New Jersey at Rutgers University at the Center for Ceramic Research. After 10 years of primary research there, Sage moved to Minnesota for the purposes of establishing a pilot line to figure out how to transfer the technology out of the lab and onto a factory floor. In 2003, Sage was one of the first companies to sign up under JobZ. With the help of JobZ, Sage was able to attract the private investment necessary to transform our company from a research company into a high-technology manufacturer. JobZ helped accelerate our job creation. It also helped accelerate deliveries of this energy-saving technology and conservation technology to the marketplace. In 2003, we were a very small company of 23 people. We have not only in the ensuing years met our commitment for job growth under JobZ, but we've more than doubled it, and if you give us a couple more months, I think we'll actually triple that job creation. These are living wage jobs, professional jobs, sustainable manufacturing jobs in a clean industry right here in Minnesota, and those jobs also include benefits such as health care. And we're talking today about mechanisms for creating job growth, and I wish I could tell you that this would happen naturally and quickly on its own in the private sector, but new technologies like this and job creation like this really happens best in a partnership of both the public and the private sector. Unfortunately, investors tend to want returns on investment a lot quicker than the 17 years that it took Sage to go from idea to our first commercial shipments. It also takes a long time to scale these new manufacturing technologies to where they create a significant number of jobs. Sage would not be shipping product today if it hadn't been for the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, many agencies within the state of Minnesota, as well as corporate investors and many, many long-term private investors who saw the potential long-term. I wanted today to speak to JobZ because programs such as Green JobZ help create sustainable manufacturing jobs because they lower the cost of capital investment to expand, they lower the risk to success, they lower the time frame to success, they help us attract private investment. And for us, that's as much a survivability issue as it is anything else. And so it's been critical for our success in accelerating the job. And I appreciate the time that I'm chair to speak to that.
Thank you very much. That was excellent testimony. Are there any questions? Senator Rosen, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 1062. Be passed and refer to Energy Committee.
To Energy. And is there anyone else here to testify that you just wanted to offer that in opposition to the bill? Or
go ahead, Steve.
We'll need to be very, very brief if you don't mind. I'm sorry. We're running out of time and we wanted to get one more bill.
My name is Steve Marcil. I'm the CEO of Rainsource Capital, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Angel Tax Credit here, and you're going to be looking at other similar bills, I think, in the future. And I'll just simply say that if it wasn't for the angel investors, there'd be no Sage Electrochromics, because when they first came in to see me 10 years ago, they had a window that looked like this and no factory. And it was individual angel investors that risked their own money being able to get that thing started. And the bill here and some other bills that are being proposed and other legislations we're working on helps us catalyze that kind of personal risk capital for worthy entrepreneurs in your own neighborhoods. So I hope you pass this along with other kinds of incentives like this.
Darren, thank you very much, Mr. Marcel. We did hear the angel investor bill last Monday. It was very quick, but we did get through it, and it has been passed on to taxes as well. So Senator Rosen moved Senate File Number 1062 to the Committee on Energy. And discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, again, we want to get into this. Senator Saltzman's Senate File 1808 related to the TIP employees. There's a lot of folks here in the audience, and I apologize again. We were in session an hour longer than we normally are this morning and going into the afternoon, so that's why we're behind a little bit. But we want to at least get started on this. I don't think there will be any votes today in 10, 15 minutes, but it's an important issue and one that's been around for a while. So, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is an informational hearing, and this bill does address the minimum wage for tipped employees. And this is obviously a controversial issue, and I would not be bringing it forward if I had not spent time with other members of this community and other legislators and talking to businesses and talking to them about many of the issues, many of the challenges that they are having in this very trying economic climate. And we've asked businesses, what can we do to help you? What can we do in terms of our mandates, in terms of our policies that would enable you to keep people working? And this bill is about keeping people working. It is not reducing anyone's wages. The way that the bill would work is that tipped employees who make over $12 an hour with their tip would not receive the additional 70 cents with the upcoming a minimum wage increase. So no employees would be losing on their wages. What I do want to, I guess, ask today is to listen to those people who are here from the hospitality industry, and I want to hear testimony on both sides. I hope that we might be able to find a resolution, because too many of our businesses are closing, and when they close, people lose their jobs. Is there a way, as we've talked to people across the state, of how companies are sitting down around conference tables and working with their employees on how they keep people working, maybe at a lesser wage or maybe with different hours? We'll also be hearing the shared work a program on that at a different time. But at this time, Mr. Weiner, would you like to make a statement?
I would. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, Weiner. Members of the committee, I apologize, but I'm recovering in a lot of ways. my name is Scott Weiner. I'm a local restaurant owner, and I am also the chairman of the legislative committees for the Minnesota Restaurant Association, Lodging Associations, and Resort and Campground Associations. The wonderful news is that I'm not here to ask for money for an industry that provides 1 in 10 jobs in Minnesota. The reason that I'm here today is I want to save thousands of jobs, thousands and thousands of jobs. Mr. Chairman, we had this meeting that Senator Saltzman was talking about, and it was a wonderful opportunity to exchange ideas, and I really, really appreciate that. Last year, year over year, the industry lost 9,300 jobs, and the market is getting worse. And according to Technomic, which is one of the largest restaurant industry observers, it could be more this year. Let's see. The key reason that we're here today is that restaurants are having a very, very difficult time, as I'm sure you're all aware. 25-year joblessness, it's the worst that it's been in 25 years. I just read an article in the paper this morning about how commercial property tax delinquency is sharply up. There's no money to be giving to anybody right now. One of the things that we're dealing with is we're working with people that do many jobs and services related to our industry. We're having to get rid of them. We're having to find other choices so that we can be able to make our payroll every single week. This isn't about getting fat. This is about saving thousands of jobs, keeping business owners in business, and giving the ability for these individuals to be taxpayers rather than to be a burden to our state. This is an incredibly important issue that we're addressing here today. We're asking for a sunset on this. We're not asking for this to go into the next 100 years. We're asking for the ability to survive right now. This is a huge issue. A point that I'd like to make, the restaurant industry, we're a hospitality industry. We're a family. You know, we know each other, the owners, the managers, the individuals that work for tips. Many of those people are in this room today in support. I don't know this individual's name offhand. Keely Youngbloom, you're a server up in Duluth, and you're here to speak on behalf of this.
Right. Thank you very much. I've been a server at Grandma's for 30 years, and I have twin daughters that are 26 years old and another daughter that's 25. And I've been single since they were 2 and 3 years old, and I've been able to raise my children and buy a house on the lake. It's a very nice house, and I've got it paid off, all with Grandma's being my only income as a server. It's also provided me a 401k plan and health insurance, flexible hours for my children. And in the last year and a half, we've lost 3 Grandma's restaurants. My twin daughters work at Grandma's restaurants that are still running as well as I do. And to me, if this raise increase goes into effect, it would do much more damage to not only myself and my daughters, but people that work so hard in non-tipped positions that won't be able to get a raise if we want to keep the restaurant still open and employing all the people that are not only trying to raise a family, but there are so many people trying to get through college and better their lives by having the great job that we do. I think by getting a 70-cent increase, it really might close my store, close one of the other stores, or at least make it really hard for the people I work with that don't get tips.
Okay.
Just another comment, Mr. Weiner, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention other things, too. Insurance. For 18 years, I've been providing insurance for my staff, management, and workers who qualify based on the hours that they're there. This is the first year where I have to go and talk to my insurance company and find out a different plan or something different, because we cannot afford to give the insurance that we're giving right now. I cannot impress upon you how critical this issue is at this time in our economy. You know, one of the things that we had talked about when we had our meeting, Senator Metzen, was that we were talking about how to bring jobs to Minnesota, how to bring businesses, and how to retain the ones that are here. It's very difficult to be competitive in our industry right now, especially in Minnesota. It's not that I want to bring up the other surrounding states around Minnesota that all do contain a tip credit, but it's an important factor in why people would choose to open a restaurant in Minnesota versus others. I basically left you a list of my notes, which I believe are in your packets.
Yeah, we have those, Mr. Winter, yeah.
I didn't want to read to you because I don't want to give a stump speech. I'm not a speaker. I'm a restaurant owner who represents hundreds of thousands of people in our state.
So that some of the neighboring states, I'm not advocating that this afternoon, but they have some slot machines in their bars. South Dakota and some of West Wisconsin and North Dakota. And it's got to generate the rent payment or the lease payments, I would think. But that's another day. That's another issue, Senator Tomasoni. Right?
I agree, Senator.
I knew I had one person that might. Senator Salzman.
There. Mr. Chair, I do know there are people who would like to speak in opposition to this, and I want to give them time as well. And I just want to, I guess, reinforce that these are trying times, and if we were able to give our restaurants some flexibility, because right now, as we have with other employers, they have the ability to go back and really renegotiate with their employees, and making this a mandate doesn't give them the opportunity to do that. So I'd like to just, I guess at that point, ask, you know, other people who are here who want to speak to this bill so we can have equal time on this topic, and that you might give us the opportunity to work together in the short time that we have with deadlines to see if there's any opportunity to come up with some language that would work for people on both sides of this issue so that, again, we can keep the doors open of these businesses.
Okay. We have time if there's a one or two that would like to visit with us against the... We might be being kicked out here in about 5-6 minutes, so we'll try to move along if you can. But we're not... this isn't the end of this issue today, of course.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Jacobs, and I am with the Jobs Now Coalition. We're 120 organizations across the state of Minnesota opposed to this bill. A waitress coming here, notwithstanding, asking to not get a 70-cent an hour raise is highly unusual. Members of this industry who work on the other side, that is the other side of the counter, need that 70 cents an hour, and they're getting less tips now. They don't have control over their over a lot of things associated with their work, and we just ask that you please don't hurt these people right now. A lot of people are in the same situation. They're raising their families on this income, and we'd appreciate that we don't even open the door to lower wages for some employees. All of our surrounding states have lower kitchen pay for all of their work. Every single state that has a tip credit pays their restaurant employees lower than we do in Minnesota. And I am here with Jennifer Schaubach from the FL-CIO and
Bill McCarthy.
Bill McCarthy from the Minneapolis Area
Labor Federation.
Okay, you want to hear from you? Welcome. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill McCarthy. I'm president of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation, AFL-CIO, and I'm also proud member and former president of Local 17 of the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union. I'm here today to oppose to urge you to oppose Senate File 1808, which undercuts the minimum wage for tipped employees by establishing a tip credit. The senator mentioned that these are trying times, and yes, they are. Today, we're facing the worst economy and most workers' working lives. I've worked in bars and restaurants. I know how hard waiters and waitresses work. They've worked for minimum wage or just a little better. Working as a tipped employee is a hard, unpredictable way to earn a paycheck. Tip credits are a direct grab into the pockets of some of our state's lowest wage workers. This type of proposal has been defeated in years past as a matter of economic justice. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to oppose Senate File 1808. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director at the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I'm actually here on behalf of Wade Luneberg from HERE Local 17, and I'm not sure if you got a copy of his letter, but I would like to just mention, because he couldn't be here, he really wanted to get this on the record. The members of Unite Here Minnesota, representing 6,000 hospitality workers, registers its opposition to Senate File 1808. While our members benefit from collective bargaining, we hope to also be the voice of thousands of other workers in the hospitality industry that do not have a union. In these extremely challenging times, we're looking for fixes that will address the problems for all of Minnesota citizens and taxpayers. To get there, we also need solutions for the business community that makes sense. This is not such a case. Advocates for a consistent minimum wage increase in Minnesota received only hours' notice that this bill would be proposed. I mention this because the chief author offered a courtesy call the evening before the bill was dropped, and in with all due respect, when we were talking about working together, advocates for the minimum wage, we met with Commissioner Sfigum last year as we were going through a minimum wage increase, so it would have been nice to have had some notice. Our coalition is a large and diverse group of organizations, and to my knowledge, none were contacted for advice or feedback. We have worked for many years to create an environment where this issue can be discussed openly. The industry, on the other hand, seemed to know exactly what it wanted and needed to do to get business done. Minimum wage as an issue needs to always have an open dialogue and communication. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Senator Salzman.
There. And to that point, Mr. Chair, I'd like to let Ms. Schaubach know that, yes, I did contact people, and that having this discussion today is opening up the dialogue so that we can hear both sides of this issue and not behind closed doors. But people, you know, I think that we've been working with many different businesses and our public employees to try to get through this. And so if we can have these discussions and have them in the open so that everybody can hear the dialogue, but we need to be listening to our businesses. And our businesses are extremely important to our state. There's a tendency to think that businesses are the bad guys and they're not looking out for workers. And in my conversations in talking with businesses and how, again, they are trying to keep people employed. They are dipping into their retirement accounts. They are dipping into their private investments in many cases to keep their doors open. And I think that that's one of the things here is that people are concerned about is that When you lay off people at a certain point, all of a sudden you lose your infrastructure and you can't keep your doors open. And this may be one of those things where we can keep the doors open to get through these trying times. No one is going to have a cut in pay. And I think that's the difference between other proposals that have actually reduced the current minimum wage to allow for a tip credit or a tip penalty, as some people call it. So I hope that you will see that I am trying to have a dialogue, and I want to thank Senator Metzen for allowing me to have this at least presentation today. We do have deadlines. If I had another 3 months, that would be great. We could have those private discussions, but this kind of puts the issue on the table, and I hope we can all have a good dialogue about it.
Well, I too thought we should. I met with Mr. Windsor for 2 or 3 hours a while back, and I said we'd get this thing at least started. But I had a conversation with the local bar and restaurant owner in my district, the district I represent, about a month ago. And he's over 60 years old, and he said, Jim, I don't have a 401K. I don't have a retirement program. My retirement program is this building. I put all my money into this, my life assets, and they, you know, 62, 63, how do I, if this goes, it's all I've got. So you have to, there's some, you have to sympathize with the industry too out there. So anyway, any questions at this time?
Carry the other bills over to Wednesday.
And we've got two other bills on the agenda. We'll carry them over.
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Can I just add here that when other people get a raise in Minnesota of 70 cents an hour, when the minimum wage bump happens at the federal level, that the fact that some workers will not get that raise is a cut in pay.
Okay, I'm just saying that we're having this discussion and we probably should be. So that's where I'm coming from. All right, Wednesday, Senator Day.
I thought I was waving to somebody. Probably.
Oh, there's not many people left over there. But all right, Senator Day.
I just thank Senator Saltzman for bringing this bill so we can talk about it. And I know it's a tough issue. Personally, I wish we were voting on the issue, but people that I talked to, I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I talked to Charlie Pappas, runs Michael's. Anybody ever been to Rochester? You know it's one of the premier restaurants. And he says, and we got talking about minimum wage, and he said, man, he says, I don't know why you people keep doing that. He says, every time you do that, it costs me $73,000. And he said, my people are averaging at $19.50 an hour. That's with their tips. And he says, they're going to put me out of business. And as people say, that as you read this restaurant thing and all these that are going out of business, I mean, somebody better heed some words because I don't know if they can handle it anymore. And they just get to the point and say, hey, you know, turn the key and call in it a day. So
it's tough out there. A lot of businesses, not just restaurants. But all right, thank you very much, and thanks, Senator Rest, for letting us go a little bit into her time.